Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age.
Hey everyone, Peter Crosby coming to you from the Digital Shelf Institute's Cape Cod office, as always, and Rob, of course, is in the Berkshires. Hey Rob.
Hello there.
Hey, just as a quick reminder to everyone, again, we're doing a whole series on D2C for manufacturers. Go to digitalshelfinstitute.org for the latest. There's such cool stuff coming up. Lots of executive conversations. The recordings of the ones we've had are up. Go for it. But in the spirit of direct to consumer, let's talk Nike, Rob. They are realigning towards digital and direct in a huge way. They're an intimidating brand for other brands that are trying to figure this out. But I want to talk a bit about kind of, there's news that happened this week, plus a bunch of the moves they've made over the past several months, and figure out, is there a path for other brands in this? So are you ready?
Yes, I am excited.
Yeah. So the big swoosh of news this week, excuse the pun, they are reportedly closing 9 of their wholesale accounts, including Dillard's, Fred Meyer's, and Zappos. This was an analyst note from Susquehanna Financial Group. Sam Poser, one of their analysts, called the decision positive for Nike as it takes control of more of its own destiny. And so, Rob, what's your feeling about this?
So this is, I know it's news this week, but there's a trend that's been going on for a couple of years now where Nike's been really cleaning up their distribution channels. So these are not the first distribution channels that Nike has shut down in the last couple of years. And in fact, this is a smaller set than, 18 months ago, they shut down 44 channels in North America. I mean, they've really been doing a lot of cleanup.
Yeah, including Amazon is one of the, in November, right?
Including Amazon, yeah. I think this is really smart. I've said it all along. I'm a huge fan of this. Big picture, a brand in the future depends on its branding more than ever. In a world where consumers have absolute choice on where they shop, where there's private label choice, where there's tons of upstart brands to compete with, it's a lot easier to substitute one purchase for another. And in that world, you've got to protect the brand. The premium nature of Nike is what makes Nike valuable. So them cleaning up their distribution channels and enables them to ensure that everywhere Nike shows up, it shows up as Nike wants it to show up. And they can keep their reputation as a premium brand. They can keep consumers engaged with them as a premium brand. And so all of this is about protecting the brand. The fewer distribution channels they have, the less chance there is that one of those distribution channels embarrasses them either in store or as a 3P seller on Amazon, the less chance they have of their distribution channels breaking price and reducing MAP and reducing the premium price that Nike can command and all that type of stuff. And so I just think that big picture, the distribution channel cleanup makes a ton of sense given their strategy.
So Rob, how does that conflate with our advice that we often give, which is brands need to show up everywhere their consumer is? Is this saying that Nike's consumer is not at Dillard's?
Yeah.
Or is it different for a premium brand, or you know what I mean?
This is a real interesting bit of tension here. You know those rules in grammar school where they say, look, you've got to follow grammar until you really understand it, and then you can break the rules intentionally for style? Yeah. Right, but first you first master the rules before you break the rules. I think that this is an example here where Nike is one of the four most recognizable brands on planet Earth, and people perceive them incredibly positively. They're always perennially one of the most admired, most respected brands in consumer research reports, and so they're flexing from a position of strength that frankly most other brands can't flex from in this particular way. So, for most brands, what we talk about is consumers use Amazon search bar as the way to discover products. And whether or not you're going to sell every single product on Amazon in volume, you want to make sure that the product detail pages, the images, the A+ content, the branding information is all what you want consumers to see, right? And so make sure that Amazon is cleaned up, make sure that it is accurate, and more than accurate, make sure that it is great branding for you. Nike has tried this, you know, in the past. And what they found is that there's too much counterfeiting on Amazon and too much, you know, duplicitous work on the marketplace for them to really stay on top of every last little thing that happens on Amazon, and it's brand damaging for them. And so they, by making these big statements, they're telling consumers, look, if you want a real Nike and you want to make sure that it's not counterfeit, you got to get it from Nike or like a very small set of approved distributors. And you know, they can do that because they're Nike, right? And they can do that because they have the luxury of being one of the top brands on earth. And most companies can't do that. Most companies cannot ignore the branding potential of Amazon and the branding risk of ignoring Amazon.
I think part of being Nike is that they're also doing the incredible investment. They're doing the work to be a brand that connects with its consumers, that personalizes for them. Like, I want to go through some of the lists that, you know, in 2017, they put up this Consumer Direct Offense Initiative, which was, they had a goal of hitting 30% digital penetration by 2023. And in their call, they just hit that in the second quarter. And now they're saying they expect to achieve that, you know, as an ongoing basis by 2021. So now they've upped it through their, at their last earning call, they announced their Consumer Direct Acceleration Initiative. And that's to further separate the Nike brand from the competition, grow digital revenue to 50% of the business, and deliver better profitability while doing all of that. And the initiatives that are underneath that, that they've been working, are really where it gives them the ability to do these things. It's not just because they, you know, the consumers love the brand, it's because they've invested in data science, right? They bought Celect, C-E-L-E-C-T, and they said essentially it gives them a team of data science wizards who use analytics to predict retail demand. So their Nike Plus membership program is using those analytics to better reward active members, utilize demand sensing technology to keep product and supply. That's given them the insights they need to be able to be more nimble.
Yeah, I think, I mean, let's just unpack that a little bit, because that's a lot to take in. First and foremost, Nike's been going to direct to consumer and building relationships with the Nike Plus program. They've also had customized shoes available on Nike.com for purchase as a way to incentivize direct relationships with Nike. Select is another Boston startup. CEO John Andrews was another Endeca guy. And the technology for Select is high fidelity statistical model created by a couple MIT professors. So Robbie, really cutting edge stuff. And Nike, because they've been investing in the consumer relationship for years now, I mean, this is not something that they just decided to do yesterday. They've been collecting data for years. That's first party Nike owned data. At some point you have enough data that it makes sense that investing in AI, statistical models, data science, makes sense, and you can use that data in order to drive merchandising, drive marketing, drive product strategy, and so on and so forth. So that Select purchase, you know, a manufacturer making a technology company acquisition, was really, really smart given all of the investment Nike had already made to that point. Now, you know, you hear us sort of over and over again talk about the benefit of first party sales as a manufacturer is that you get first party data. You know, that data isn't valuable the first month you're doing it. It's not valuable the second month you're doing it. It's not valuable the sixth month you're doing it almost. There's a snowballing effect where you have to be at it long enough for the data set to be large enough for it to really, really materially matter. And Nike plays the long game. They've had the conviction about this for years. And so they're getting to a point now that the owned consumer relationship and the first party data combined with statistical modeling, I mean, you're right. Like, they can make these bold decisions that to the outside, people will say, oh my gosh, you know, could Nike do without Dillard's? Like, isn't that going to hurt their top line? Even, you know, they know better than the outsiders, right?
Right. And in this moment where store sales are suffering anyway, they were down for them as for everyone else in Q2, it's kind of the time to say, well, we're going to take these hits anyway. Let's realign so that our top line is being driven more and more by our direct. And they've done a bunch of strategic leadership shuffling to do that. The second thing that they've invested in to support all this is the supply chain. So they're using RFID, digitally tracking products, which allows them to track them through the production process until the item sold to the customer. And because of that and getting materials in place faster, they were able to cut jersey lead times in half when LeBron James moved from Cleveland to LA last year. In half, Rob.
There's a couple things in there that I think are worth disentangling. First is the RFID tracking. Nike, because it's a premium brand, and you know, brands like a Canada Goose or a Moncler, or you know, you're talking about really premium, respected brands. They're not easily substitutable with private label. They're not easily substitutable down market. The brand actually, the patch and the swoosh and all that matter. Nike suffers from counterfeiting. There's a lot of bad actors out there that make fake Nike shoes and try to sell them for real Nike prices. And that's a problem. And so Nike has worked on solving that problem on their own because Amazon has not done enough in Nike's eyes to solve it. So they've got this system where they can track shoes all the way across the supply chain, almost at the individual shoe level. And so that's one type of investment, which is really interesting. And you see other luxury brands doing that. And Nike's price point, you know, they're a premium brand, but they're not really a luxury brand. It's not a multi-thousand dollar purchase to buy a pair of Nikes. So it's interesting that they've taken that technology and process down market. It's another indication of how much they care about their brand. The second thing you said is the investing in supply chain agility. The ability to pick and pack and ship eaches, to create custom shoes on demand for individual consumers, and the ability to, as you said, switch out jerseys when LeBron James changes teams. Those are all related to each other. Those are all reflections of big capital investment that Nike has made on their supply chain over years to get to a supply chain agility that is, in my view, a huge competitive advantage for the digital shelf and the fast changing nature of everything that happens in this modern digital era where the consumer's in charge. Yeah. So again, just like the data, this is not Nike waking up overnight and doing these things that we're talking about as news items today. It's like an overnight success that took 10 years.
Yeah.
Nike has been doing this for so long that all of a sudden when the world changes, they're in a great position to take advantage of it.
Yeah, when Chris Perry kicked off our D2C strategy series, he was talking about sort of every company needs to find their value prop for D2C. Like, why are you doing it? What is it you're going to do that will make it differentiated and interesting and worth the consumer investing and journeying to you direct rather than one of your partners? And what he talked about is that personalization is one of those things. Like, if you can pull off personalization, you know, just the M&M's example as simple as that. And for M&M's, that didn't change their top line business all that much, but to create a relationship and start getting them their data. So finding your way to what that is for you as a brand is super important.
And I just I went to a direct to consumer thought leadership summit with the MidOcean private equity group out of New York. They own like KidCraft and Nutribolt, Hunter Fan, a bunch of mid-market manufacturers like that produce quite good products. And one of the discussions was what type of brand is safe from Amazon competing with them, or safe from Walmart competing with them, or Kroger competing with them, or in the world of private label and easy substitution. And one of the key areas was this area of personalization. And if a brand can do that, it's not like the personalized product is the product that saves you, because you can't sell millions and millions and millions of them. For all kinds of reasons, but personalization is not going to be the thing that saves you exactly. What saves you is the fact that a person who has one personalized item on your product is more loyal to your company. So there's a customer loyalty, customer engagement, branding part of this, plus data collection to test and learn on what people are personalizing and what's going to become popular, what designs matter, and where are people gravitating towards, and all this sort of stuff that makes these strategies really sound when you invest in them over a long period of time. I mean, Chris Perry covered a lot of this stuff, but this is what the game is becoming, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I have to drop one additional little fact in this sort of supply chain thing, just because we are content geeks. Nike recently digitized its full palette of 6,000 footwear materials. So that allows them to be able to, their digital design teams to coordinate across all the design teams. And when consumer trends come up, they can respond faster than rather than dealing with it in its analog form. And I just think that centralized sort of capacity, it makes a big difference, and brands should be thinking about what if their march to market can be digitized so that it just can be quicker.
Yeah, there's a startup in Boston called 3XR, and it was founded by the folks that built the AR program at Wayfair. Mike Festa is the founder CEO, and one of the things that they do is they provide a material library that enables folks to build really photorealistic 3D models of all kinds of things, cloth, teddy bears, chairs, couches, things like that, where you basically can't tell the difference between something that's computer generated and an actual photograph, right? And that's what Nike's doing here. Nike's building their own digitized library of what the texture models look like so that folks that are inside Nike, the designers, can basically use 3D rendering to create new shoes and mess around with shoes and do those types of things. And then also, once they create shoe prototypes, they can actually get those shoes using, computer technology into the world before the shoe even exists.
Right.
So that you can create 3D models of the shoes. You can put those 3D models on actors or on athletes. You can put them in Fortnite. There's all kinds of things that you can do once you have the true digitized 3D version of the shoe. So Nike's looking forward to AR. They're looking forward to VR. They're looking forward to the metaverse. And they're investing in the core capability, the texture modeling, now.
Yes.
So, is AR going to be a big deal in a month? No. In 2 months? No. In 4 months? No. How about virtual reality? No. But in 5 years, or whatever timeline, it absolutely will be. These are inevitable changes. And Nike's looking ahead. They're looking out 5 years. They're playing the long game, and they're thinking, what are the things that I need to get good at right now for when these things matter? Yeah. It's the same as they did with the direct-to-consumer relationship and data. It's the same that they did with the supply chain agility. And now they're doing it with the 3D rendering capabilities for the future. I mean, it's just, I really, not to be like a Nike fanboy, but they're doing a lot that's there to like.
And in the meantime, while they're doing that, this digital catalog takes the airtime, so much airtime out of each sort of step to market. And as you said, up to and including the time where I can start getting this product to market before it's ready to be shipped and before we have the physical product in our hands to take photos of. Like, it's so smart. And every brand has the capacity to do some version of that within their supply chain and their go-to-market strategies.
It takes, the thing that it takes more than anything else is a lot of these things are, expensive investments, but not that expensive. It's mostly courage of conviction of leadership. It's mostly looking out of the future, making a strong statement. This is what's coming, and saying, we're going to prioritize working towards it. We know that the ROI is not this year, but we're going to do it anyway, because we know that that's what's coming. Not all companies have that type of leadership. There's a lot of folks that are run by more operational leaders or sales leaders that came up that are, came up in a world pre-digital shelf that are mostly playing a lot of the same playbook that they've been seeing for years and years, and Nike is not. And so you see the differences and all the news that's happening today is news that's been in process for years.
And you see digital happening in retail at Nike. They have the new Nike Rise store format. The first one debuted recently in Guangzhou, China. And it's a digitally enabled journey that reacts to data from members of the app when they hit the store and to real-time sports moments in the city. The store is like right next to a sports arena, has a Nike by You personalization bar, a new app feature called Nike Experiences, which turns the city into a digitally enabled playground for members. And so they're going to get that format, and it's a smaller store format than what they have now. So it's actually less of an investment, but it's a more interesting experience for their members that's connected to their passions, right?
It's great.
Yep.
Hats off.
And another thing that we're seeing is how they're thinking about their digital teams. And by teams, I mean not only their in-house, but also their digital partners and agencies and stuff like that. In July, Nike dropped Publicis Razorfish as a digital media agency, and they're talking about in-housing. They're not looking for a new partner. And we've been seeing that trend, Rob, to cut costs and provide greater control and to simplify cost structure while building their own digital capabilities in-house. There's a lot of brands that are starting to do that.
Well, first, I'm just going to push back on one thing you said there. This is not about cost. Companies have done comparisons on, you know, working with agencies and going in-house, and the cost isn't materially different in one way or the other in a lot of cases here. I think this shift, though, is a really, really important shift. And if you allow me to stand up on a soapbox for a second, people in large corporations spend too much damn time in meetings. You try to talk to a bunch of folks that are in the e-commerce team or the media team or the branding team, and they're in meetings 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. You can't get anything done. And so the people that do a lot of the real work in these companies are not the employees. They just have run out of time and they just outsource it to agencies. At the end of the day, if you're Nike, though, and you're looking to control your brand and you're looking to control your brand experiences and you're investing in the future, you want your own employees to be the ones with their hands on the work and expert in what they're doing. And you want to have that capability and experience and, you know, alignment with your cultural values and all those types of things in-house. That's what this is about. It's not about cost. It's not about, you know, cost structure. It's not about savings. It's not about any of that stuff. It's about Nike very intentionally wanting to control their destiny. I mean, can you imagine another brand that's very controlling like this? Can you imagine Apple, you know, having, hey, outsourcing that next iPhone design to, I don't even care who, like, pick the number one design agency on earth, IDEO, right? Can you imagine Apple saying, hey, IDEO, I don't have time.
I don't know what to make
iPhone
here.
Why don't you design this iPhone for me, dude? It's like, no, they're not going to do that.
Yeah.
Apple's going to do that themselves. Nike bringing this stuff in-house is just a realization that this is no longer business as usual. And Nike having their own expertise on this is a competitive advantage versus using the same agency a bunch of their competitors use. So I think that's what this is about. Even if it's more expensive to do it in-house, I think that it's the right move for them.
So Rob, with all of that, you know, we've been fanboying here. Just because when I was really researching for this, these number of things that pile up into a really intentional strategy, not surprising. But if I put myself in the mindset of a lot of our listeners who are trying to figure this out and are some number of years behind Nike in thinking about this vision, what's a brand to do? What is the more traditional brand approach?
Well,
because you know.
It's a good question. I mean, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
Yeah.
I like it. You know, that's all you can do is one foot in front of the other. You know, there's another quote that I'm just going to absolutely butcher here, but you can drive 200 miles in the fog, seeing only 10 feet in front of you and get to your destination, right? Mm-hmm. The important thing is to know what your destination is. You might only know what the next 10 feet of the road look like, but then you'll have another 10 feet, and then you'll have another 10 feet, and then you'll have another 10 feet. So trying to do all this at once, I think, is insane.
Yep.
Trying to do it over a long period of time makes a ton of sense, but you know, you got to start now. What's the best time to plant an oak tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is right now. You know, I don't know how many of these aphorisms you can throw out there, but basically it's just pick a future and get started. I think that a lot of brands, they look at these activities and they think, oh man, if I can't do all of that in the fiscal year of 2020 or the fiscal year of 2021, then it's going to be a failure. I encourage them to look at the iconic essay, 1,000 True Fans. I don't care if you're a $50 billion global category captain. If you don't have a direct-to-consumer strategy, it starts with the first 1,000. It starts with finding those folks that buy you over and over and over again and love you. And getting those relationships direct instead of through an intermediary. And you just build on that. And every day you come to work and you build on that. So I think the biggest challenge that brands have is, first of all, vision, like I said before. And then second of all, picking a small enough win And being content that the small win is actually materially important in the big picture, and not losing sight and not getting ADD because it doesn't seem to impact the corporate bottom line this year or next year.
Bob, I hate to put an assignment on you, but I think you just found your next DSI blog post topic, which is taking that essay and putting it in this context. Because I think that essay, A, is brilliant, but B, I think putting it in this context will be really helpful. So if you don't mind, I just assigned you that.
1,000 true fans of the brand.
Exactly. It's where it begins. And you know, thinking about that, one of the just privileges of doing this D2C strategy playbook series is I get to talk to these executives who are actually in the seat doing this. And on Wednesday, September 2nd, 1 p.m. Eastern, James Seidel, VP of Digital Commerce, McCormick. And McCormick has this simple brand vision. It's make every moment shoppable. So McCormick's not going to go out and like drop Kroger's or something, you know, that's not going to be their strategy. But however, they do have a direct-to-consumer strategy. Their Old Bay hot sauce story, James is going to talk about that and sort of in a be careful what you wish for moment. It just was successful beyond their wildest dreams, and they learned a ton of lessons. Like to your point, sort of moving the 10 feet in front of you through the fog, but doing it intentionally and taking the learnings from it is what every brand needs to be doing right now and making sure that they're getting more control over their own destiny.
Yeah, also, you know, less meetings.
Less meetings. Yeah, I have to say.
More work.
Yeah.
Spend less time talking to each other.
At our organization, you know, largely from your leadership, the shift we've made to having at least 2 mornings a week dedicated to focus time has transformed, I know at least my capacity to actually think creatively. I was one of those people that was in meetings every minute and then go, all right, now all the work I got from these meetings, when am I going to do that? It's been transformative. So
I'm gonna do a war on meetings. It's going to be my Twitter handle from now on, war on meetings.
Stop talking to each other. Well, as we take on yet another war to change the world of commerce, manufacturing, and lives, that's it for our one podcast for the day. Again, please do join us on September 2nd. The link will be in the show notes. The recording will be available at digitalshelfinstitute.org shortly thereafter. If you like this conversation, we'd love it if you left a review, bring more people to us. Thanks for joining us, and thanks, as always, for being part of our community.